Welcome to another episode of the House of Wisdom podcast, where we interview academic influencers about their research and how it can shape the world. I'm Deepak Moore, an academic.
And I'm Carlos, also an academic.
Hello, how are things?
Hey, pretty good. I mean, a lot of grading to do, but pretty good. What terrible chat that I have for you today, Deepak.
I've got very sad chat. My wife's bike got stolen.
No.
And it sucks. It's I know it's like the number one crime in the Netherlands, and you should just kind of accept that for what it is, but it still hurts.
Right.
Because we went to Alpenhain, we parked up. She has a second lock, and we just never use the second lock. Because my fault. I'm always like, that's fine. It's okay. And I've gone to that Alpenhain countless of times in the last year and a half that I've been in the Netherlands, and it's just never happened. And we came out and I looked straight away. I was like, it's gone. Oh, no. And I don't think that my wife clocked onto it, and my friend who was visiting us this weekend clocked onto it until they got closer and closer. I'd already like, this is bad news. And yeah, sad times.
Probably just to explain, so Alpenhain is a supermarket, right? So it's not a place where you're thinking, oh, definitely bikes are getting stolen outside of here. And at the same time, I completely get your wife's reaction, because my first instinct whenever I've had something stolen is always immediate denial. No, my eyes are lying. At some point, it will just materialize the thing.
It's just on the other side.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Is she upset? Obviously.
She's upset because it was a birthday present from me to her. So I think it digs a bit deeper. But it reminds me of quite funny incidents of bikes getting stolen when we were in our masters. Mm-hmm. We had a particular friend, I'm not naming her, but she had her bike stolen, got a new bike, was really happy and excited about it, but hadn't had a lock yet. She went into McDonald's and came out and it was gone.
It's so quick, isn't it? I had a neighbor the day, right, in like the neighborhood group chat. Yeah, we have a neighborhood group chat because we're so cool.
Yeah.
She wrote, she was in her kitchen, and there are windows pointing to the road. Mm. And she apparently watched someone steal her bike in under a minute.
That's amazing.
She was like, okay. I wasn't fast enough to go knock on the window.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she saw it and he was off.
Yeah.
But in the Netherlands, it's just, yeah.
Yeah, for those Dutch residents, those back wheel locks are not enough to, like, double barrel that lock and make sure, you know, you throw the key away just in case, it is a painful experience.
Yeah, and it's a continuous one that you're not escaping. To be fair, I've kind of escaped it. Am I tempting fate here? I haven't had a bike stolen yet in the Netherlands.
I've had a very similar experience. I've not had my bike stolen yet, but watch next
month. Join us next week.
Join us next week, bikeless. We'll start off, you know, welcome to the House of Wisdom podcast. I'm bikeless, Deepak. And
and also bikeless.
Yeah.
Talking about our master's time, today's guest is someone who we probably idolize is too strong, but we spent a lot of time reading. Or is idolize not too strong?
I definitely would say, I think, someone who really inspired me to get into international law. Like, for me, it's like someone that I just revered, definitely. That person. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Actually, I got a very funny story about the first time. So our guest is Martti Koskinemi. For those that are part of the international law discipline, the international law world, he doesn't really need much of an introduction. I remember actually the first time I came across him, or it was a really funny experience, because I did my PhD at King's College London, and I walked into the law building and he was just sitting there, and I just had this double take. I was just like, what? And he just looked at me like, what is wrong with you?
What do you want?
I think I was so starstruck. I just didn't say anything. I just looked at him, stared at him, and just kind of walked away like really glumly. And then as I was in the lift, I was like, this is probably how most people feel about celebrities when they meet somebody who's got starstruck. That's the experience I just had, which was pretty funny in that sense. But I've talked to him, I've engaged with him multiple times, and for someone that is so well recognized and so highly respected in the field, I think the biggest compliment I can give to him, he's just such a nice human being. He's always so welcoming. He's always willing to you know, engage with you and talk to you regardless of who you are. And I remember sending him an email, like, oh, I'd love to, when I was in my undergrad, saying, oh, is it possible I could be like your research assistant? And he didn't have to email me back, but he actually did and said, no, I'm, unfortunately, right now, I'm not looking for anyone. So I think one of the nicest things I can say about him is he's just such a nice human being. And then on top of that, just an incredible academic, you know. We're looking at the Michael Jordan of international law scholars here.
Wow. Wow, you've started it now. Now any basketball fans are going to be like, wait a minute, let's have a conversation. Who's the Michael Jordan? No, but it's true. A very influential writer. And I think it makes sense that you have a reaction like that to someone who you've read, right? Because when you're doing a lot of reading and you keep reading books from the same author and you're recommended books from the same author, there's also that kind of, you have this weird personal feeling with them. Yeah. Like you kind of read all this stuff and you feel like you know them until you meet them and you realize, oh no, I've just been reading your work. I don't know you at all. And it's always inspiring. And yeah, I was surprised he emailed back at all. You were so confident, like, yeah, of course he's going to email back. I was like, there is no way. Then bam, I think like a day later. Yeah, sure, no problem. So good. He doesn't need an introduction also for those who are not international lawyers, because we will ask him to do that himself. It's quite hard to introduce someone in general who's done so much, so probably best to ask the person themselves.
But before we get into that, I think it's important to talk about what we're talking to him about, because I don't think we're talking about international law really with him, are we? We're talking about the academic experience and what is academia right now. And it's almost kind of biographical to a certain degree. It's like his experience of academia and how it's changed, how he would like to see academia move in towards a certain direction. And I think that is kind of the crux of why we have him. And I think it's a really interesting and engaging conversation as a result of that. And I think it's kind of nice to set the context in terms of, I felt that me and you were like these students learning something from a teacher who's kind of passing on his experience and his knowledge, and be like, yeah, this is what I've experienced, and maybe try to do something differently, or try to take on what I've said and think about how you apply your work or apply your research with that kind of same idea or theme. So then, without further ado, let's start the interview.
Welcome, Professor Koskinyemi, to the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
We've told you already that we both have studied international law. We're both international lawyers. But we're going to do something a little bit potentially blasphemous to our colleagues. And we're going to have essentially a conversation with you which doesn't touch on international law all that much. And in that sense, we want to begin this conversation with you as if we've never met you. We're really interested to know, if someone has never met you before, or imagine we've never met you before, how would you introduce yourself?
Well, I need to introduce myself every now and then to people who haven't met me before. So I think the first thing one says is, well, I'm an academic from Northern Europe. And then I imagine that they develop some sort of an idea. And then in order to counteract that idea, I would say, but I'm not academic by background. I used to be a diplomat for almost 20 years before I went to the academy. And so that hopefully creates an interesting tension between two kinds of careers. And I suppose also for the purposes of this discussion, it's useful for you to know this.
And I think that's just like a great starting point in terms of talking about how you got into academia, having this kind of practitioner's background, and starting from this world and then transitioning over into academia. I mean, what was the inspiration? What was the kind of the realization, okay, I want to actually go into academia? And where did that start, and how did that start?
Well, it was quite coincidental, actually. As I said, so when I graduated from law school, I decided I want to do international affairs, and I took the foreign ministry or the foreign office exam, and I passed. And so right after law school, I went to diplomacy, and I was always posted in the legal office, both in Helsinki and then in New York, which was my only longer posting there in UN matters. And I thought that I would always, I always thought I would retire an ambassador one day, maybe from Paris or Moscow, if things could turn well. But then if they don't turn that well, then for some more remote place. But I also found that the academy was a really intellectually, the foreign ministry was an intellectually interesting place. And there were lots of colleagues who were doing postgraduate work at the same times. Many were working for a PhD either in Finland or more often elsewhere. I got a British Council grant in after I had been in the Foreign Ministry for some 3 or 4 years to go to Oxford for a year. And it was there that I started to think, well, it's not impossible for me to try to do a PhD as well on the side of the work. And so I was 17 years in the Foreign Ministry. And so in the course of the years, I started to write small articles on foreign policy related matters, legal articles on those matters. I was surrounded by colleagues who were doing that as well. So we were constantly hanging out at each other's doors and talking about what we were doing. This person was in the WTO. I was doing the law of the sea stuff. Somebody was looking into European matters, the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, etc. And that was a very academically oriented office in which I worked, although it was a legal office in the Foreign Ministry. And that inspired doing this legal work. And then it started to accumulate. There were more articles and lengthier ones. And I had more interest in theoretical and historical questions behind the law. I did my PhD while in the Foreign Ministry in 89. This was then became the book From Apology to Utopia. The PhD done at the Foreign Ministry. And then I was posted to New York thereafter. I was thinking, well, you know, it will be kind of a UN career. I had nothing against that. But then the professor of international law in Helsinki retired earlier than he should have because of personal reasons he had. And they contacted me from the university, Martti. So, are you interested in professorship here at the university? And I said, well, I can try it for a year. And so after a year, I thought, well, you know, it has its size. But there was this freedom that was hard to, you know, counteract. And so with a heavy heart, I said goodbye to my really interesting and academically oriented colleagues in the Foreign Ministry to step into the stale water of the academy.
Wow, the stale water of the academy.
Well, I like to say this. So I may exaggerate a little bit, but not too much. So when people asked me a couple of years into the professorship as to how did I feel about this this change, so I said that, well, I felt I came from an intellectually inspiring environment where all the colleagues were constantly conversing intensely with each other as to what to do with those problems, into a place where everybody held their doors closed and nobody was talking about much anything, and people were very careful not to reveal their new projects or talk about those projects unless they had already published on those projects. And that was weird, and I have to say, to some extent, disappointing. Of course, there were advantages in the academy, but I want to make this point with some emphasis that I felt that the Foreign Ministry work was academically and intellectually more challenging than the context of the academy at the beginning.
That really rings true to me a lot in terms of, I think when I went into academia, I thought, okay, this is this opportunity to just liberally just explore and go into various fields and various issues that I'm interested in. But then you do realize actually there is a bit of a rat race structure that's in place that doesn't really allow you to do that in a sense, in terms of, let's say you are interested in something that's a little less mainstream or a little more obscure. There is not that interest, and it's almost hard to kind of allow yourself to then just freely explore topics and issues that you find interesting because of the pressures of being an academic and some of the responsibilities or the conditions or obligations that you might have. So it's kind of interesting that you did say that, because I that really does ring true to me in a certain sense that there is this idea.
I'm not saying exactly that. So it wasn't the rat race aspect although I recognize it was there. But so I came directly in as a professor, having never had a lecturer job or a postgraduate job at a university. And it was, you know, life tenure. Mm-hmm. So no rat race in that sense. And this seemed perfectly natural to me. I had the appointment in the Foreign Ministry would have been a life appointment. What I really mean is that that the dynamism, which in the practice was directed towards some project or other that a couple of people shared together, and they had a common interest in advancing it. So let's say you had a set of proposals in a law of the sea context. So you had to go to the conferences, you made your alliances, you had the people who were on your side and those who were your adversaries. You had to strategize about it. You had to think whether it's a good idea in the first place or not, etc. So I really liked that. I liked the satisfaction, as I sometimes said, in the UN in some resolution, when some resolution comes up for a decision, and then you endlessly negotiate through the long nights of the General Assembly sessions, for instance, in the autumn, and you find this feeling of satisfaction once you get it passed, and with your friends you go to a Second Avenue to a bar and you have a couple of drinks there and you elaborate, weren't we good or didn't we fail miserably? That sort of thing. So none of this in the academy. So none of that kind of camaraderie, a sense of a joint project. And when I said stale water, so what I mean is that, and this may have been, so it was different at NYU than I think there was a big difference between the academic context in which I then associated myself at NYU or in the US in general and in Finland or in European universities in general. And I'm talking about the European universities. So there, the professors, each one had their own project and they were a little bit secretive about those projects for whatever reason. And they didn't want to talk about them before they had published on them. There was, of course, a lack of resources also, so that they're among different disciplines. So you were a little bit envious if some extra money went to the private law sector or to the constitutional lawyers, and you had to struggle a little bit with that. We didn't have that sense in the foreign ministry. Of course, there were also lack of resources was an issue, but that was not a big issue that affected us as who were working there as legal advisors. And so it didn't affect our work that much. Whereas in the university, the question of the lack of resources was a constant shadow over everything that one did. Again, I'm speaking now of a European university, University of Helsinki.
And I think I like this differentiation between, of course, where the universities are, and then, of course, then we can talk about different faculties, and then there's also the contextualizations and the contingencies of who's in these faculties. But you were also talking about how it was and how it is. And I want to maybe see whether you've seen any difference, right? You build this picture of academia can be quite a, let's say, singularly focused place where academics think of the self rather than potentially a collective goal, like when in your work in the ministry. Has that in any way changed from when you first?
Absolutely. Entered? Absolutely. And I want to underline that what I said earlier on had to do with the very moment when I moved and my phenomenological experience of that move in 1994. Now, that's a long, long time ago. And since then, the funding arrangements at the Academy, for instance, have changed a number of times. I was able to set up with colleagues an institute in the law faculty. To have that institute gave me and my colleagues an independence, also gave a sense that we have a project and we were doing critical legal work. And all of a sudden, all of us identified ourselves as something else than those people over there. And that sense of common project was really important. And then we started within the institute to gain money. So we did a lot of consultant work because of my contacts in the foreign ministry, for instance, or in the Finnish government. We were able to write reports on various aspects of international legal relations of Finland or Finnish ministries abroad. And even of companies too. And that gave us a financial independence. And then we started to receive also financing from the Finnish Academy, which is the general academic funding system in Finland. And more and more postgraduates came to the institute, started to want to do PhDs because they had this heard this rumor that in Helsinki you could do critical work. And I, of course, did my best to encourage those rumors and my colleagues as well. And then this became different. But this came with a cost. So we were doing international law We were quite separated from the rest of the law faculty and self-sufficient. I got an ERC grant at one point and directed that for that. That took several years, and we had our own premises and so on. I got two successive Finnish Academy grants, not quite as big as the ERC, but nevertheless big in Finnish terms. So that created an independence. But as I said, it separated us also from the rest of the academy in ways that, you know, what's not ideal, to put it in that way. But I would say that the voyage, the academic voyage I've taken from 1994 to the present marked a constant development in the way I started to feel about the academy and started to enjoy being there and started to think of it as a project or a set of projects that were similarly meaningful as the projects that I had in practice earlier on, although, of course, by their substance, they were very different kinds of projects.
And I think that leads us really nicely into discussing the role of the academic. I think one of the reasons that myself and Carl really do this podcast is because sometimes we worry about how the academic community is seen outside of that community. How do the everyday person see our value? I mean, we live in a world where there is a allergy to facts and to experts. And sometimes I worry that perhaps we don't do enough as a community to engage and to participate in the wider discourse. And what's your general feeling about that? Do we do enough? Do we need to do more? Is that even our role to do more, to actually engage with the wider public?
My first reaction to that would be, well, that's very different in different parts of the world, isn't it? I've had the privilege of teaching in many places, in Europe, in Latin America, and of course in US. So I've been associated with NYU, New York University, as a global professor since 1997. So I know that context pretty well. And I would say attitudes in the general population towards academics are very different in these different places. And they have also developed. So it's one thing to say that, yes, there is a popular apprehension about experts. And now I'm not sure whether one can say that an expert, one's attitudes towards experts is the same as one's attitude to the academia. One might appreciate the academia and hate experts, for instance. I can imagine that sort of thing happening easily. Or maybe the other way around. One hates the ivory tower sense of the academia, but thinks that, you know, experts who do practical things are really great. So there are all these combinations. So I would really refrain from a very large generalization in respect to that question. I think it's a whole range of attitudes people have towards the academy and another range of attitudes towards experts. They don't all often coincide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. No, I definitely agree with that. But sometimes I do get concerned when the academic institutions are kind of paintbrushed as these kind of radicalized left institutions that are brainwashing the youth. Sometimes you do see that discourse. And I feel sometimes, is that a result of perhaps the academic community not engaging enough with the wider public and to show, you know, who we are as people and how we engage with these topics and of interest? And you know, why is that, you know, why is that kind of depiction being created? Of course, there's other aspects and other influences, but from that concern, it's that idea of, do we need to engage more and do we need to do more of that discussion with the wider public?
I don't think this is a question of marketing or contacts or PR work on the academy's side. I have a very simple answer to that. The more you know about the world, the more you learn about the world, the more your political views are divert towards the left. So this is as simple as that. I've seen that take place in myself, in my colleagues. I find it utterly understandable. I think the world is tremendously unjust. So especially the inequalities are staggering. And the more I work with academic materials, historical materials, legal materials, the more it underlines the staggering and unacceptable nature of the way the world is. And so that's, I think, the basic reason.
I've got a different question now based on the fact that you have worked well, you've taken, let's say, big projects with the history of international law, you've engaged with theory. But what you've shown, I think, in your research, that there is value in engaging in other disciplines, in cross-disciplinarity, should we say. I heard you mention this phrase, counter-disciplinarity, in the recent speech you gave at the University of Tartu. And I wanted to hear some more about this. What does this mean? Cross-disciplinarity, interdisciplinarity, we hear this all the time. Counter-disciplinarity seems to be something quite a bit different.
Yes. So I've, of course, engaged throughout my career in interdisciplinary work. And one of the problems of interdisciplinary work is that one never is as conscious of one's own disciplinary orientations than in interdisciplinary work. So paradoxically, interdisciplinary work often strengthens the disciplinary attachments of those who participated. I feel like I'm very much a lawyer when I'm working with people who are and speak of themselves as anthropologists or theologians, etc. And they invite me to collaborate as a lawyer. And so there's a role for those kinds of projects, to be sure. But I think so often the outcomes haven't been very successful. And I am more and more come to think of the disciplinary attachments that people want to take as part of the problem of modern governance, and especially expert governance. So it's not just a question of academic identities or ways of academic collaboration. It's also about how experts identify themselves as such, and how do they phenomenologically, again, how do they feel about their own expertise? And there I would need to say that I feel that experts need to be able to take a critical view on themselves, on their own discipline as experts. And you can take that only by stepping out of the paradigms and the truths of the discipline to stepping outside. And now that doesn't mean necessarily that you adopt the perspective of some other discipline, although often it helps. But I think a more fruitful way to think about this is to resist disciplinary orientation of any kind, and to try to take the position of what I called in that talk that you mentioned also, enlightened amateurism. So to try to think how would a set of problems look like if you didn't have your own disciplinary tools, and if you just thought of it in an amateurish way, both about the project itself as well as especially the costs for other people and the attitudes of other people towards the project, its possible success or failure, whatever it is. So I agree that counterdisciplinarity that I every now and then use is a little bit provocative, and I don't have a theory about what counterdisciplinarity might be, apart from the fact that it signals a wish to step out of a very strict disciplinary attachment by the people who exercise it.
And if we could stay with this idea of stepping out of your discipline, but maybe switch the focus and, let's say, stepping out of academia, right? So the subtitle of this podcast is how academic influences, how their research can shape a better future. We don't have to get into a conversation about what a better future would look like, but imagine someone does wish to pursue a better future. They're an international lawyer, and they begin to question whether academia is the right road. Right. So if they want to defend human rights or whatnot, there are those who would say, well, not only should we step outside of a discipline, potentially we should step outside of academia and go work. Let's say do the opposite move to which you did, from practice to academia and move from academia to practice. Do you have any thoughts on this?
I have complete sympathy with that idea, utter sympathy. And historically speaking, the academia has often been a place of conservatism and staleness. For instance, in the 18th century, no French intellectual of any significance would ever have stepped inside a university. So you had the salons, and you had the groups of individuals freely associating with each other. Of course, these were upper class individuals, but nevertheless, they hated the academy, and they felt that what they knew about the academy, which was in France in the 18th century, was mainly the training of priests or theologians. So they thought that that was really part of the problem. You had to be outside the academy in order to see clearly. And I can, you know, in the Soviet Union, there were clearly moments when you could not think of yourself as doing worthwhile intellectual work while in the Soviet academic system. I don't know about now, but I have a sense that many Russian academics are feeling that the academy is not the right place in Russia any longer to do significant work. So yeah, sure, absolutely. And then there is also the sense that they in European or in the standard academic world that, as we know it, it also creates its own situations of malaise or situation. I've used the word staleness maybe too much here. So it starts to become to navel gaze and to circulate around its own problems that have very little to do with the problems of the surrounding society. Academics are often men and women of some privilege, and I think that privilege should be employed in order to help those who don't have that privilege. Now, that's often, it's not often obvious that the academy should have that dimension as well. And if it doesn't, then I suppose you should just go out and do something else.
So on that line of thinking, I think I'm thinking in terms of myself and Carl being those younger academics that are learning our crafts. So how would you tell us to kind of maybe do that, to actually try to engage outside of the academic community? And what would be kind of the approaches that perhaps you would encourage us to take or adopt to do that?
Well, together with David Kennedy, we are publishing next year a book of conversations on history, power, and political economy. And in that book, we rehearse themes that both David and I have been rehearsing in our individual articles many times about expert governance. So that with the thesis that a lot of rulership, a lot of power is now in the hands of experts. And so if you want to engage with society, you want to have to engage with experts, and you have to engage with what expertise is, which means that you have to focus on the training of experts, which of course takes place a lot in the academy, and how to do that. Well, I said a few words already on counterdisciplinarity. One could also say more about the politics of expertise, how modern politics often takes place as a politics of knowledge. That is to say, as a politics in which the most important decisions are about which kinds of knowledge we believe that should be employed in order to solve this problem. So to take a really banal example, so do you want to interview sociologists or theologians or economists? So these are three groups of people who come from regimes of knowledge that have their own biases and their own policies, and one should think about them in those political terms. So knowledges clash in the world. You can't step outside of knowledge to think about how to manage that clash of knowledges. You're always inside there in some place. And I think an articulation of the clash of knowledges, knowledge regimes, environmental knowledge, trained knowledge, human rights knowledge, military security knowledge, etc. So those clashes are where rulership takes place and where intervention by active people who wish to have an effect on society is needed, and where that intervention can be most efficient. Now, it's not easy to intervene because you have to have knowledge and you have to have a critical attitude towards your own knowledge so that you can participate efficiently and understand what it is that other knowledges do, what are the benefits they offer, but also what are the costs that they entail when they are being made operative. So it's all that world of expertise and various knowledges into which I would like the young academics to focus on when they think about engagement with modern society.
So as we're wrapping up this interview, we're going to end with our usual question, which is, and kind of alter it for this interview is, imagine that you had to stand before the academic community and talk to them about how to engage with the wider community and the wider public. And you had some time in the House of Wisdom to draft this up and spend some time in there and explore the House of Wisdom with many books and everything and all the pluses that we got in the House of Wisdom. Who would be that person that you would choose to help you design this speech and this piece of work to talk about the role of the academic?
Oh boy, who would that person be? Well, my partner would be a good person to.
Excellent.
Yeah, I suppose. So she has much experience in administration and in thinking about administration, and she's a really intelligent person. To say something else would be unduly preposterous for someone in my privileged position of, you know, having her as my partner for, you know, many decades.
And hopefully both you and your partner can enjoy House of Wisdom with all the treats and delights that we hope and imagine it has within it.
Indeed.
And with that, Professor Koskinemi, thank you very much for your time. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Professor Koskinemi.
Thank you.
So that was our interview with Martti Koskinemi. Deepak, I remember discussing having this interview with Martti before we recorded, and you very much were interested to see, okay, how is he going to reply to these questions about mm-hmm. how an academic is meant to engage with the public, how the academic is meant to engage with the layperson. How did you feel that went? Were your questions answered, or what's your sentiment right now?
It's an interesting one. I think perhaps what I would do differently if I was to do the interview again was perhaps not try to lead Martti into a certain direction. I think maybe I could have just gone with him in terms of the approach and the perspective and his experience of academia. Because I think I was really interested in talking about the role of the academic and whether or not we have a responsibility to make sure that our research, our opinions, our perspectives are out there and we're countering some of the debates and discussions that are taking place in this society that we live in. So I think maybe perhaps it wasn't the right time. And I got something else out of it in terms of, you know, what it is to try to be an academic now and what are things that we should think about and consider. That, you know, I like the idea of being collaborative and having this sense of a team, working as a team and achieving something collectively. And I think that is something we perhaps don't do enough, especially in social sciences, especially in the areas of international law that me and you cover generally, right? We do international legal philosophy, international legal theory, and there can be that easy tendency to just fall into just doing it on your own and not engaging with other people and not being collaborative and not working as a team. And I think that is something lacking, especially in our fields. I think less so in natural sciences, where the team aspect of it is really important. But yeah, how much can we learn, especially for something like international legal philosophy? It is all about your perspective. You're kind of putting your perspective onto paper and you're engaging with these philosophies and these theories and trying to give you a perspective. And sometimes that perspective can be so much more enriched by the idea or the opportunity to actually engage with another person and to really think about your perspectives and views. So yeah, I think the idea of collaboration and that sometimes being lacking, and that being a surprise to Martti when he actually engaged or entered academia, was an interesting thing that I took away from.
Yeah, I think it was really important to get to that point which you asked me about, which was, okay, was your feeling about the staleness and lack of camaraderie in academia the same at the end of your career as it was at the beginning when you entered academia? And, you know, you said, no, actually, right now, things are getting a bit more collaborative. And of course, not in the same comparable sense of camaraderie that may be felt in the halls of the ministry. But yeah, I mean, I feel that there's some sense of collaboration. But like you said, it completely depends on what you do. So we have friends who are in the natural sciences, whether it be biology or chemistry, whatnot. And they write papers together all the time. I think I said to someone once, like, you know, so I'm writing this paper. And they're like, well, who with? I was like, what do you mean, who with?
But for them, it was so strange. Like, you're not working with anybody else. You're not building anybody else's research.
Yeah.
And it's a real different approach to how research goes. I mean, we have maybe conferences, research labs, workshops. We discuss our ideas, but then we go back. And, you know, everyone's very thankful. You'll see always in a footnote somewhere, thank you for all the help from XYZ. And I think it's important to do that.
I was just thinking, when I first started talking to natural science academics, they would talk about, I'm second author and third author. And I thought, that's a really weird concept, because he's just like, I'm just writing the paper on my own. And it is a very different experience. But I really want to be a bit more collaborative, not just about in terms of just getting help, but actually writing with other people. And I think that also helps us dissect our various different perspectives and different approaches and find common ground, which I think sometimes is lacking in common discourse now, right? We're so polarized, we're so, you know, stretching to the extremes of any agenda, any topic. Actually, maybe engaging in academic research with someone maybe you don't necessarily agree with and finding some sort of collaboration and finding some sort of common ground, that can be really, really meaningful research, not just in terms of the specific topic, but actually practicing the skill of engaging with another person you don't agree with and understanding the commonalities that you have. So collaboration, not just in terms of people that you agree with, but people maybe you even disagree with, I think is a very, very important thing to do beyond just the realm of research and beyond the realm of academia.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I think I was listening to a podcast where Neil deGrasse Tyson says that he reads consciously books that he thinks he's going to disagree with. Yeah. And that once he had to write a list of, okay, so what books do you have on your bedside table? And then everyone was like, I didn't know you were conservative. I didn't know you were so right-leaning. I was like, no, it's not me. I'm just reading these books. I find it important to have a broad understanding of the different perspectives which are there, which is important. I think when Koskinyemi was talking about feeling very much like a lawyer when working with his other colleagues who are philosophers, for example, I got that. And I felt that. I always felt when I was presenting my work to the philosophers that I was just coming from a completely different place.
Yeah.
Right. And I had to learn very, very slowly because I wasn't, let's say, very naturally gifted with philosophy. If you can be naturally gifted at philosophy, I had to really slowly learn how everybody talked to each other, that the questions they were asking were probing questions. It wasn't just to destroy work, but, you know, it was a kind of critical approach. And we didn't really have that in law school as much. I'm not sure if I'm remembering it correctly, Deepa, but we did have a bit more collaboration than the philosophers, I feel.
Okay. One thing I want to say is stop knocking yourself down because you
I'm
are
English,
are...
mate.
Yeah, speak for yourself. I'm the bee's knees. God, yeah. So stop knocking yourself down. You're very, very, very good legal philosopher. So don't be so hard on yourself. But you're
insert
right.
Heart emerges.
But you're right in terms of, I think it's not something that we practice, and generally we need to. It also leads me on to something else I want to talk about in terms of counterdisciplinarity, which is what he talks about. And I think that is quite relevant for what your experience is in terms of you are engaging with a slightly different audience. And rather than, let's say, having that collaboration, we're thinking about, I'm the lawyer and I'm coming in as a lawyer. You are the philosopher, you're coming in as the philosopher. Actually break down those barriers and just start engaging. And try to utilize the knowledge and the skills you have rather than being, like, let's say, bogged down by it, I think is something really important. And that's perhaps where we can really do a lot more effective collaborative research on a cross-disciplinary agenda or approach. So, I think it's really, this day and age, I really, really, actually any day and age, I think it's really important that we do interdisciplinary research because it's so valuable, especially for social sciences. You can't really look at society from one perspective, and to be able to appreciate those other perspectives in your research is really valuable and really key, and we need to do more of it. But the way we do it shouldn't be, you know, through that identification of your role, but actually be break down and just be open. Because that's what I got really from Marty's discussion. Like, everything was quite, like, free-flowing in the way they collaborated. And they just kind of had a task. They tried to do the best they could. and they work to it together. And I think that's something that academia can take away. But as Marty said, that is something that's starting to become more of a phenomenon within academia, within research. So yeah, I think the ideas of kind of disciplinarity, the idea of being more collaborative, I think these are really, really essential skills that all of us can learn to be better academics and even just be better professionals beyond the academic realm.
Do you think we could like maybe design courses around this? Where we have, okay, as one module, like a university degree, we're going to mix faculties and you're going to go write a paper with just whatever you're interested in. Let's say someone's writing on climate change and they're a lawyer. Yeah. They have to go talk to someone who studies, I don't know, the natural occurrences of rising temperatures in rivers or something, right? I mean, this could be a good way of doing it. I can imagine it'd be challenging, but...
But I think that's fantastic in terms of that's what you would do in the real world, right? I mean, if you were... Let's say having a government role, a governmental role, and you're, let's say, the legal professional, you're going to have to engage with people that aren't so comfortable with legal vocabulary or how the legal mindset is. And so to be able to engage with those that are natural sciences or economics or politics or philosophy, I think that's a really important skill to have, not just to rely on what you know and only engage with people that can then speak the same language, but also talk to other people, because that's going to enrich in whatever you do, whatever task you're at, especially if you're dealing with something like climate change. You need a multidisciplinary approach to that. So yeah, I think something like that would be very, very beneficial.
And face-to-face, right? Not just through reading. There was this word that Professor Koskunyemi used, which was that, you know, we should resist disciplinarity and engage in enlightened amateurism. Mm-hmm. It's been racking my brains up. Enlightened amateurism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he wanted us to think about how a set of problems would look like if we just thought about them in an amateurish way. Mm-hmm. Kind of feel like I do that with many things, because we're aware of our limits, I hope, at least. Mm-hmm. unless whoever's listening to this has no limits, and the AI
is
knowing everything. But in a certain sense, I wonder whether sometimes we're discouraged from this, right? You're told to not be
I was thinking more like a jack of all
armchair
trades almost.
Don't be a jack of all trades and armchair philosopher. Why not? I mean, we're living only for a short time on this earth. Why not try and experience as much as possible, try and get involved in certain things? I'm not saying that someone who leads a government, for example, should engage in enlightened amateurism. They should probably work off the skills and professionals of all those around them. Yeah. But if we're talking simply about learning more about the world, great idea.
Yeah, and also having an impact on the world. I mean, if that is the reason that you're in academia and you're doing the research that you're doing, I think, sometimes not being the master of a specific area of philosophy or specific area of law can sometimes help you understand how an audience that's not in academia will perceive this and will understand it and find complications or issues that perhaps you wouldn't because you are the expert. So I think sometimes having a bit of enlightened amateurism would actually be really beneficial for us to perhaps provide solutions to contemporary issues and contemporary problems.
Do you think it'll help us find solutions, though?
Or at least help us understand certain things that are going on within society, right?
Yeah.
I think it would help.
Yeah, definitely. But now I'm thinking too much about enlightened amateurism.
But I think it's a really, really cool, interesting topic. And this is why I'm really glad that we didn't just talk about international law.
So what happened then when you had a response to whether or not we should just leave the academic, whether we should just leave academia? He's like, sympathize with that.
the other funny thing I found was like the amount of times that me and you were just laughing. When he was like, I finished my PhD. It was from Apology to Utopia.
I remember when I started my PhD with all the insecurities that one has when starting a PhD. Someone told me, you should really read the whole of From Apology to Utopia. It was great. Oh, that was Matti Koskunyemi's PhD. And I was like, really? You had to put that expectation on a PhD?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, man. Cheers. Thank you. Thank you very much. And also like when he's like, I came out with a PhD and they offered, obviously, yes. Marty had a lot of experience in the foreign ministry, so it's not like he was a 23-year-old. I was like, professorship? But it was quite funny just now because advancing in your career is a little bit tougher than, let's say, it was in a past time. So it was just really funny for both me, because I remember looking at you and you giggling a little bit. It's like, yeah, they offered me the professorship. It was open. It was the vacancy was open, so I went for it. And it's like, I dream of those. And even in my dreams, they're still like, no, go back. Come back in like 20, 30 years and maybe we'll look at
you. The other professor retired. They contacted me, asked me if I wanted it. I was like, yeah, this is great. I quite enjoy it. You know what? And of course, like, there has to be said that, you know, he is great. So it's not completely far fetched, but these aren't stories you hear often now, if at all.
Yeah. Last thing.
Go on.
I find it really endearing that he mentioned that if he was to do like a speech about the academy, he would bring his wife with him, which I thought was really lovely.
Facts.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you got to bring those people close to you. I, don't get me wrong. I mean, when it comes to choosing who you're going to bring to House of Wisdom, it always makes sense when people choose these great inspiring figures. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, if you really think about it, who's going to keep you all together?
Yeah.
Right? It's those close to you, whether it be your partner, your family, your friend. And I don't know. For those who have those people that get them through academic lifestyle, they would have heard that answer and gone, yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
Yeah. Your partner is your rock. Amazing. Okay, so what an episode. It's a really weird experience. I remember talking to you about it. As soon as we did it, I was like, oh, no, it didn't go that well. And then I listened to it again and thought, actually, this is really, really good stuff. And like I say, describe it as two students learning from the wise sage that has been there and done that and has got plenty of words of wisdom to share to the world. Hopefully, when I'm doing my research now, I can really take that on board and pass that on. All right, so we do our usual shout-outs. Well, when I say shout-outs, just promoting us. Please promote us. So yeah, like I say, follow us on Instagram, follow us on Twitter. We're going to start being a bit more active on Instagram. We're going to stop being old people, rather. Start being, you know, the modern man.
look, there are elderly people which are going to put us to shame. Our social media prowess is... it's not the one, but we had great conversations and now that's it. We're committed, right? We start getting some visuals together. We're going to tweet. Yeah. We're going to Instagram. Yeah. So hopefully we can provide some more consistent content for you guys soon.
So yeah, find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is Pod of Wisdom. Look for us on Instagram. We're House of Wisdom Podcast. Follow us. Engage with us. Tell us what we should do. Tell us if we're wrong. Tell us if you agree. We want to hear those perspectives. We want to engage with you guys as much as possible. And we hope to hear from you soon. So, Carl, please end it for us.
As always, thank you very much for your time, for listening, for dropping by. And we'll see you next time and the next episode of the House of Wisdom Podcast.